Near-Death Experience podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours.
Welcome to Near-Death Experience Podcast, the official source of audio accounts for the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author of Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side, as well as the music album Home. Today we're going to share two near-death experiences, both from NDERF.org, the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website. First, we will read the experience of Kustoff, and then the second is of Marie. So, Kustoff says, I went to the bank near my house. I walked past a group of stoners. They saw that I had exited the bank, and they told me to give them my money. I told them to forget it and kept walking. They began to follow me, but I kept walking and ignored them. After a while, I turned around to confront them. I told them to stop following me. I said that they had nothing better to do with their lives than to harass a random citizen of the town. After this, one of them pulled out a hunting gun. It was not the same as the guns people use in the U.S. or guns portrayed in media. It was a rather small gun. A regular shot would not have done much, but one of the young men put the gun to my head. He told me to give him my money. I told him to wait one second while I was reaching in my pocket for my wallet. He understood that my saying 1 second was a form of resistance, even though it was not. He shot me. Suddenly, I hovered over my body. I could see one of the youths kick me in the head as the group walked away. I tried following them while shouting at them, but they could not hear me. Another person who had witnessed the whole thing from afar had already called the police. Help was on its way, but it needed to be fast. I watched as the paramedic came. 3 men came out with a stretcher. What does it matter? I thought. I'm already dead, so this is absolutely useless. I ended up leaving this scene. I was able to float very quickly. I was surprised that there didn't seem to be any spirits yet. I decided to go to the farmhouse that I grew up in as a child. I went into one of the fields and found the grave of my childhood companion, my cat Elmer. I remember he died when I was 10 years old, and I missed him ever since. I could see my messy childhood handwriting as it said Elmer. The sky went completely black. I could not see anything. It was almost as if nighttime had just suddenly come, without any warning, without any lights. It was utter blackness. I saw a bright white light. It was going upwards. I decided to float up towards the light. I managed to float into the stream of light. Suddenly I felt very cold and was shivering. As I was rising, I saw snowflakes. I saw a piece of floating land in the distance. It had one pine tree and covered in snow. It was still so cold, but I decided to go to that tree. Below the tree, I heard a meow. I looked down and saw Elmer. Elmer was a white Persian cat. I couldn't believe it. He was watching me. His beautiful green eyes and long, luscious white fur. Suddenly, I realized I had hands. I was surprised by this. I picked up Elmer. When I held him, he purred. No longer did I feel cold. His fur completely warmed me up, and I felt the energy of his love. It was just like old times. I began to cry in feeling of happiness. I could even smell him exactly the way he used to smell. I put him down and could tell from his purring and rubbing up against me that I would be okay, whether that meant returning to life or staying on this floating island. I then realized Elmar's eyes had the same look as I remembered when something got his attention. In one giant leap, he leaped off the island and into the horizon. I was alone. Then I heard a very powerful voice. It told me, "Gustav, it is not your time to die. Elmar will be here waiting for you when you get back." Suddenly, I started floating backwards against my will. It felt as though I was getting pulled back. I was floating back down. I saw Elmar's grave once again. From there, I was floating back until eventually I could see the hospital where I was. I saw my body lying unconsciously on the hospital bed. I went inside my body. I woke up, but could not talk. I felt pain, but I felt warmth in recalling what I had just experienced. And that is the end of Gustav's account. I'm going to go ahead and read Marie's account before we go back and talk about the different aspects of their accounts. So Marie says, "On December 13th, 2012, I was preparing for Christmas. I was stressed, and it was when exiting a shop when the accident happened. I stepped into the crosswalk and started dashing across the street when I was hit by a motor scooter. I have no memory of this at all. A total void. I know the facts only from the police report. I was hit by the scooter and fell into a coma. It was at the intensive care unit that I saw myself leaving my body through the top of my head. I was looking at myself from about 2 meters above my hospital bed. I could see my body attached to a bunch of lines connected to some machines. I knew that it was me, but I was somebody else. It's difficult to explain. Kind of like a doubling up. It was me without being me. Then I saw my life scrolling past. I saw only very pleasant times, and I passed by that very quickly. It was more like feeling than seeing. It was like a kind of teleportation at incredible speed. I think of where I was as a tunnel because it was round and everything was dark. I sensed that at the end there was a light that was immensely beautiful, filled with love and serenity. It was just a sensation, but a very powerful one. Like knowing there was a wonderful world at the end of the tunnel. In a split second, I entered this light. Then I became this light of sparkling brightness. I saw the light, and I also was the light. I was a kind of energy filled with love, protection, and knowledge. I can access this powerful sensation even now. Whenever I try to speak about it, the feeling is overwhelming. I felt that I was surrounded by hierarchies of angels. They were sending me infinite love, immense protection, and their knowledge. The love was more powerful than anything I had ever felt before, even though I am a passionate sort of person. The angelic crowd became even larger. I sensed that there were great spirits surrounding me and sending me their knowledge. The most powerful spirits were in the forefront. They were the very ancient consciousnesses who taught a kind of universal Kabbalistic knowledge. They taught me the divine and universal knowledge that I, an earthly human, was immensely important to them. I realized that I was in another world. I asked them who they were. Their time was very long. My great-grandmother and great-grandfather appeared on my right. I hardly knew them as they passed away when I was a child, but there they were, holding hands. They sent me even more love. It was ecstasy. I asked them where my sister was. My sister had committed suicide 27 years ago. They all left for a few moments and then reappeared. My great-grandparents let go of each other's hands. Behind them, and very far away, I saw a sparkling light with something like wings. I knew that this was my sister, even though I couldn't exactly see her. All around her, there was the same love that I felt surrounding me. She also was surrounded by a dark circle of angelic hierarchies. My great-grandparents told me that she had needed to go through this, but that now she was finally ready to come help members of her family. Then I grew immensely large with huge wings that started to emerge from me. Like a phoenix, I was ready to fly away. The sensation was not only impressive, but was extraordinarily pleasant. Then these wings very rapidly retracted back into me. At that point, I traveled all the way back to Earth, into the ICU, and down I fell into the shell of my body. I woke up in intensive care without knowing who I was or why I was there. Nearby, there was an old man groaning. This is where my nightmare began, because certain members of the medical community were hostile to me. I learned later on that this medical community had thought that my cranial trauma had been so serious that there would be no chance I could return to consciousness. They did not like to be proved wrong and took it out on me, telling me just be quiet and more. Today I realized that I had an extraordinary experience. Now I have this certitude that death doesn't exist. Because when we leave this world, we go to a new world of love. I feel that they made me come back because I still have things to do in this life. Today I'm thankful to them that they were there. I'm happy and thank heaven for bringing me so much joy. But there is another certitude, that the awareness of the French medical community has to be awakened, absolutely. They still consider me a nut when I talk about my experience. What I needed when I woke up from such an experience was somebody to listen to me, not somebody to drug me with antidepressants so as to prevent me from thinking about the experience. What I needed, they have no idea about. That is the end of Marie's experience. Okay, so let's go back and first talk about Gustav's experience. So both of these experiences have some unique elements in them that seem uncommon, but not unheard of in near-death experiences. When Gustav dies, he first finds himself over the body and kind of just like, you know, why are you guys working so hard? I'm dead. Obviously, I'm dead. You know, he just kind of takes this in and he's kind of rolling with the punches, so to speak. But, and that is interesting, but it's also not uncommon. It's kind of, you know, sometimes people will not realize they're dead when it first happens. But he obviously does, and he seems okay with it. He's like, all right. And then he thinks of his cat. His cat Elmar that he had lost as a child when he was 10 years old. And he thinks of this cat because he goes to the place where he grew up as a child, and in some form or other he sees his own childhood handwriting that says Elmar. Now, I don't know if he wrote it on a rock, you know, like a little gravestone for him, or if this was something, you know, maybe he'd written it as a child somewhere, or perhaps he was simply seeing his childhood handwriting of the word Elmar, of the name of his cat. Regardless, when he sees this, the sky goes completely black and he finds himself in what we would call the void. But he sees a bright light at some point, starts floating towards it, and as he's floating toward it, he begins to feel very cold. And this is where the experience is unique, I guess you could say. This is where it seems to be a little bit of an outlier. Okay, it says that he starts feeling very cold and is shivering. It's uncommon to feel any kind of unpleasant physical feelings in these kinds of experiences, but he's experiencing it. And he sees snowflakes, which itself is not too strange, except, you know, him actually feeling cold. And then he sees this floating land in the distance. Now, I don't know what exactly this looks like. Is this some kind of distant horizon thing, like in the blackness he's starting to see a horizon? Or is this like, you know, the never-ending story when they come around this rock after Fantasia has exploded and there's the ivory tower, you know, right there? I'm kind of picturing something similar to that without, obviously, the ivory tower. But he sees this floating land in the distance, and it has one pine tree, and it was covered in snow. So he goes there, and he hears a meow, and he sees Elmar, his cat. Now, if you are new to near-death experiences, you're probably thinking, okay, he's having a dream, obviously. This is bizarre. But honestly, this seems to be very common in near-death experiences, having experiences where there's something that just kind of outside of what you would expect. And sometimes there is symbolism behind it. Sometimes there is a, something that kind of draws your focus to a particular thing. I don't know if this is an example of that or not, but being this floating island in, I assume, the sky that he is floating in, and he goes on it and finds his cat there, I'm wondering if there's something symbolic about this, about basically saying, we're not going to show you all of the landscape on the other side. We're just going to show you this little piece where your cat's going to greet you, in order to have you focus on the cat and why this, you know, meeting him on the other side was important to you. And that does seem to happen, which makes me think maybe that's why he saw it like this, because it's hard to believe that Elmar is this cat that is happy just living out his eternity on this tiny island with a single tree covered in snow on it. That's that doesn't seem likely, but honestly, that's kind of consistent too, that he wouldn't be living on that, because he does at one point jump off of the island, off into the horizon, whatever even that means, and into the blackness, into some distant, you know, I don't know. But we don't have to assume that this is some kind of hallucination. We don't have to assume that this is not a true near-death experience. In fact, I think it's very characteristic of near-death experiences. Is there a little floating land somewhere where Elmar the cat sometimes hangs out? Maybe, I don't know. Or was that something that he saw because his spirit decided that he needed to see that, and therefore it is not quote-unquote real? Maybe there's a little bit of that, but I think he probably really did encounter Elmar. I think the spirit of Elmar was there and came to greet him. I don't think there's any reason to doubt that Elmar was real. You know, as to the floating island and things like that, well, I don't know. I don't know. Cat can go where it wants in heaven. So can people, apparently. So, you know, why not on a little floating island at the time? I don't know. Something to think about. Then he hears this voice that says, it's not your time to die, and Elmer will be here when you get back. And then, boom, he's sucked back. And there's something about this being sucked backwards thing that keeps coming up in near-death experiences when people go back to their body. I'm kind of picturing something akin to the scene in, now if you haven't seen this show and you want to, then you're going to get a little spoiler in the next 30 seconds, but in the movie Somewhere in Time, Christopher Reeve, I don't remember his character in the story, but he is out of his own time. He's gone into the past. He falls in love with this girl. And there's this moment where he pulls out of his pocket a 1979 penny, which is from the future, which is something that would clue his brain in or prove to his brain that he is in the wrong time. Because it was this weird hypnotism thing that he did for himself to convince himself he's back in that time, which sent him back in that time. And as long as his brain subconsciously remains convinced of that, then he stays there. Anyway, he sees this penny, and suddenly there's this kind of sucking away, and he sees her shooting off in the distance as he is pulled back through, I don't know, some kind of tunnel-like thing. And he's immediately back in his body. I'm kind of picturing near-death experiences where they're sucked back into their body like that from some kind of beautiful situation as having that same feeling about it. And that is the point that things are unpleasant. That is the point where a lot of distressing near-death experiences get their distress. There are certainly some where the content itself is genuinely horrifying. But more often than not, when people describe distressing aspects to their near-death experience, it's the coming back, being sucked back away from the joy and the love into their body. But I do want to go back just a little bit about his cat, Elmar. Among the questions that I get from listeners, there are a lot of questions about pets. Mostly, are pets in heaven? Are there pets on the other side? And this, among, I mean, dozens, hundreds, probably thousands of other near-death experiences attest that from everything we can see, absolutely pets are on the other side. Often they are the first to greet people when they get to the other side, which for anybody who's had a dog knows that that's usually the case when you get home from work too. You know, you get home from work and they're the first to greet you. You know, even before your kids can get there, the dog is right there. Sometimes cats too, you know. And I don't know, I think that's beautiful. That's something that's very reassuring. And many people even find themselves getting signs from their animals who have died. And, you know, I don't know a lot of the mechanics behind that and so forth, but little things that, you know, their animal would normally do, sometimes they'll hear sounds or you know, smells or different things that were associated with that pet. And there's no known reason for that to be there, or that sound or that smell to be there, other than that their pet is greeting them in some way. So, you know, even pets seem to not only be on the other side waiting for us, where they will greet us when we get to the other side, but also they seem to once in a while pop in to say hi in some way. And I don't know how that works, but it seems to be the case. Okay, so about Marie's experience. Now, I can't find anything in the account to verify, but I get the impression, since she talks about the French medical community, that she's either in France or some place that's associated with France in some way, if they, or, you know, and I don't know whether this was a translated experience. It doesn't say anything about that, but it'd be interesting to know exactly where this happened. I'm going to assume we'll just say France, okay, for the sake of context here. And she's getting ready for Christmas. And in the rush of Christmas stuff going on, she rushes across the street on a crosswalk and is hit by a motor scooter. I assume some kind of motorcycle. She goes into a coma. And, of course, she doesn't remember anything but probably motor scooter coming out of nowhere and then, you know, and then blankness. But what she does describe from her perspective is that she could see, and this is interesting, she says, I could see my body attached to a bunch of lines connected to some machines. So she is somewhere in the hospital. She says, I was looking at myself from about 2 meters above my hospital bed. So about 6 feet above the bed, she is looking down at her body. She says, I knew that it was me, but I was somebody else. It's difficult to explain, kind of like doubling up. It was me without being me. Which is to say that she's looking down at her body and her own experience is what she's looking from. And her own personality is where she's looking from. And then a life review begins. And hers is interesting because she describes it as not being something that she sees so much as something that she feels. And lucky for her, she is only shown the very pleasant times. And that passes very quickly. It makes me wonder if maybe she is given this life review, this pleasant aspects, you know, the good parts version of the life review, in order to convince her if she wants to come back, because she needs to come back, because she does. And so that's a possibility. And she goes on to have a very, you know, kind of a traditional tunnel and light experience. And when she's in this light, I'm unclear and trying to remember, I don't see it said, if she's in some kind of landscape or what. But anyway, she's there with family. There seems to be her great mother, great grandfather together, filled with love. And in the midst of this, this is an interesting part because this is another question I often get from listeners, is about suicide. What happens to those who commit suicide? And this offers an interesting perspective on that question. She says, I asked them where my sister was. My sister had committed suicide 27 years ago. They all left for a few moments and then reappeared. My great-grandparents let go of each other's hands. Behind them and very far away, I saw a sparkling light with something like wings. I knew that this was my sister, even though I couldn't exactly see her. All around her, there was some sort of love that I felt surrounding me. There was the same love that I felt surrounding me, sorry. She says she was also surrounded by a dark circle of angelic hierarchies. My great-grandparents told me that she had needed to go through this, but that now she was finally ready to come help members of her family. Okay. And then suddenly she changes the subject, which, you know, we can talk about more. Maybe, you know, we'll see. But there's so much packed in that that is so interesting. It appears, if I'm understanding this right, that her sister has been somehow separated from the rest of the family, probably not in a permanent sort of way, but that somehow there's something that she has to go through before she can fully, I don't know, rejoin her family or fully, you know, help her family in some way, because it says help members of her family. But she's surrounded by angels. She's surrounded by the same love that she felt surrounding her. But there is some sort of separation. She's seeing her sister at a great distance. I don't know what this means. Is this a symbolic distance? Is this some kind of spiritual distance? I don't know. But her sister is surrounded by angels and by the same love. But she's somehow separated. And her great-grandparents explain that her sister needed to, she had needed to go through this. And what's this? I don't know. She doesn't really specify. But that now she was finally ready to come help members of her family. Now, I can only guess what all of that means. But based on other experiences that I have read, I'm under the impression that maybe what happened was that her sister, having committed suicide, is brought into the light and is enwrapped with angels and everything that she needs and begun a healing process. Many people talk about healing, and you would think, well, what does she need healing for? She's not even in her body, and her body's the thing that's broken. It's a spiritual healing. Spiritual healing is absolutely as essential to the spirit, I gather, as physical healing is to the body. And anybody who's experienced either a severe injury or illness can attest, when your body is down, you are down. And it affects everything. Spiritually, the same thing occurs. Now, we don't see it as obviously here, because we're in such a spiritually dark place and situation that, you know, it's as if everybody is somehow spiritually deadened or dying or hurt in some way, because we're all in this very difficult, challenging world. But and so it's a little harder to see that. But the healing that takes place spiritually, it may take time. And even on the other side, where time doesn't exist, there is some sort of period where someone who is deeply spiritually maimed or spiritually injured has to go through a healing process of some sort. And it is just as, you know, loving, just as filled with compassion as those who don't go through that. But it is some kind of healing that they are going through. Because even though their body is separated from them and therefore pretty much unaffected by anything that, or that they are unaffected by anything that happens to their body, their spirit still may need healing. And those in the situation of committing suicide are usually in a very spiritually dark place. And that is not to say that they are at fault or that they are, you know, self-murdering, you know, sinners or anything like that. But they are spiritually hurt. They are deeply, deeply spiritually hurt. And they need to go through some healing. An interesting aspect to this, what she says about after that healing, she's told, but that now she, her sister who had committed suicide, was finally ready to come help members of her family. This is interesting, and I say this based on other near-death experiences that I've read, because there's no more evidence given or details given about that this here. But I have heard of several near-death experiences where members of the family who have been either abusers, or perhaps they committed suicide, or were somehow, you know, in some examples, you might hear, for example, generational abuse or generational drug addiction, you know, where basically the family is broken because of some kind of you know, malady of sorts, abuse, you know, addiction, pornography, anything that can just absolutely rob the heart, mind, and relationships of life, can be generational things that go on. And in some near-death experiences, people who have died, who were abusers, for example, are often, they go through some kind of healing, and then they return to help influence their posterity, to help their posterity overcome that chain and to break the chain of abuse, to break the chain of addiction. These people who were instigators in their life after being victims of their life and their genetics and so forth are now sent to help their family to overcome. Each one is striving to break the chain of addiction and abuse. And when it is successful, it makes it all worth it. And that is, those who were the instigators of abuse, for example, don't want that to continue in their family. There are very few people, if any, that come to this life and live out lives of pure evil. In fact, I would suggest that most instigators of evil were victims of the absolute worst sort before they became instigators of the worst sort. Not always, but most often. And it's that chain effect. They've had, their minds have been broken by what they've been through to the point where they don't know what else to do but carry on with that same tradition. But it's comforting to me that those who caused this are also the ones that are coming back to try to heal it. Now, I don't know exactly what this sister's role is or would be, because all that Marie says is that she was finally ready to come help members of her family. But if she has committed suicide, she may be coming back to help her family to prevent further suicide or to break a chain of suicide if there has been more in the family history. I just find that interesting and beautiful. Now, the next thing that happens, she suddenly changes the subject. And this is interesting, and this is another thing that makes this a little bit of an outlier experience, because this doesn't happen too often. She says, "Then I grew immensely large with huge wings that started to emerge from me." So she feels herself growing. Physically, well, spiritually, you know, but she feels her body, her essence, whatever this is, she feels herself growing, not only larger, but then sprouting wings. And then the wings, it says she's ready to fly away. And it was not only impressive to her, but extraordinarily pleasant to experience. And she says the wings rapidly retracted back into her, and then she travels back to Earth and, you know, fell into the shell of her body, she says. Now, what's with the wings? I don't know. It's interesting. Is she becoming an angel of sorts? You know, we know from near-death experiences that angels can have wings, they can be without wings, they can be you know, departed loved ones, and they can be people that we've never met, or at least not in this life. But and sometimes they even take on forms that we are not familiar with, humanoid forms that you would not call Homo sapien, if you will. Now, how does that, what is going on there? I don't know, except to say that there are more beings in heaven than just us people and chickens. Nobody here but us mortals. There's a lot more than just us mortals in our spirit form. There are beings of every sort. And this also brings up the question, maybe there's more to our being than what we know. The idea of having wings, is that all symbolic? Is she just seeing that as a symbol of her ability to get around or to be free of something? I don't know. But I think it is useful to keep an open mind about these things and just say, we're not sure what's going on there, but it's interesting. And there's possibility that there's more going on there than we know, which is so cool. Anyway, Marie ends her account by basically sharing her testimony that life does not end with death, and that we need to open the eyes of the medical community to these things because people are not crazy when they talk about these experiences. Marie says that they still consider her a nut when she tries to talk about her experience. We need to talk about these experiences, not to convince each other of anything. That's not the point. The point is these need to be normalized enough so that when somebody comes out of a nearly dying experience, possibly even near delirious with pain or with, you know, drugs or whatever, they come out saying, "I saw the light. I spoke with God." We need to take that seriously. We don't have to consider them a prophet sent to give us a message from God. We don't have to do that. But we also don't have to discount what they're talking about and saying. We should hear it and say, you're not alone. People are having these experiences and they're seeing this stuff. What you're seeing was real. And then leave it to the individuals to interpret for themselves what it means. Because you do get a lot of people trying to say, oh, that happened because this happened, which I do all the time. You know, I'm constantly interpreting these experiences, and I hope it's clear when I do that this is my interpretation, my understanding. But sometimes people get over the top with their experiences or with other people's experiences. You know, somebody says, oh, I saw a light, and, you know, they said you need to return. And people are immediately told that was the devil and he was trying to deceive you. What? It's not fair for people to jump to those kind of conclusions and so forth. What we should say is, that is amazing. Please tell me more. Or thank you for being willing to share that. Tell me more. Even if there's things about the experience that we don't understand, don't agree with, it's totally okay to not believe or not understand the specific things that happen in people's experiences. Be willing to listen and be willing to not put them on antidepressants because of them having some kind of experience. Rather, listen, hear them out. Understand that for them this is not only reality, but it is a life-changing experience. And the more we do that, the more we can start to really look at these things in a meaningful way. Because I can guarantee you there are thousands of people every day who are having experiences that they are, or I should say that there are at least hundreds of people who are having these experiences every day. And many of these people are not willing to say anything because they don't want to be told they're crazy. They don't want to be given, you know, crazy drugs, basically. So if you are in the medical community, if you know people in the medical community, please talk to them about these things. Don't try to convince them of anything. Just say, just so you know, these things happen. And if people say stuff about this, you don't have to think they're crazy. Because they're not crazy. There's too much coincidence between their experiences. There are too many shared, similar experiences. Anyway, if you would like to contact me, you can email me chaz@ndepodcast.org. You can also support the podcast by either going to neardeathexperiencepodcast.org, clicking on store, and then buying either the book or the album that's associated with this podcast, the ones that I've done. And also, you can become an ongoing monthly contributor if you desire by going to patreon.com/ndepodcast. You guys, I don't want you to feel the slightest bit guilty or bad if you cannot contribute in some way. I don't want to push you in any way. I just want to make it known how you can do that if you want to. Just your being here is enough for me. And just your occasional messages of thanks keep me fueled up to keep going with these things. I've just learned this week that there will be more languages versions of this podcast, which is so cool to me. We now have this podcast going in different languages. It's not me translating or being translated. It is others sharing experiences just like I'm doing in their own language, which is so cool. It is so cool. And, I haven't talked to, enderf.org. We have been getting permissions from them to add these additional shows and so forth. But if you fluently speak a language that you know is not, that this is not being translated into, contact me, contact John, and or contact Jody or Jeff Long directly. Their contact information is on the website enderf.org, and ask them if you can start a Chinese or Japanese version of this show, or whatever language you're familiar with, Filipino, Tagalog, I guess it would be, version of the show. Because the more we get this out there, the more the information gets out there, the more we can start really, really learning from these things. You know, the internet was a mind-blowing, world-changing, revolutionary piece of technology. And it was not the technology itself that made it so epic, but rather it was everybody getting on board with it. In the late 80s, the internet existed, and all the, a lot of computer geeks were using it and so forth, but it was computer geeks talking to computer geeks, basically, or military operations using it for, communication or whatever. But once it became the general public thing, and emails became a thing, and information started being put on the internet, it exploded. And it was not because the technology itself just caused it to, but it's because everybody got on board with the technology. I use that as an example because what I'm suggesting is the more people hear about these experiences, the more people will begin to explore these experiences and begin to study them and seek to understand what's going on. The more we'll start getting into the science and medical communities where we can start looking at them from a more deeply scientific perspective and be able to start measuring them with the tools and rigor of science that goes beyond what I can ever do. And the more we do that, the more we can learn about ourselves. This can be a beautiful spiritual, scientific thing. We may have once thought of spirituality and science as being incompatible, but there's no reason for that. We used to think of the mind and science as being incompatible. Now we see them as branches of the very same thing. Psychology, sociology, there's every different branch of, neurology, the brain, and all this is very, very scientific. There's no reason that we can't make these things scientific too. Not that that should be the only thing that we do with it. Of course not. We should also explore these things spiritually, religiously. I just feel like the more we get the word out there, the better we can learn and grow and get this message of love out to everyone. This is not a ministry per se, even though I may kind of treat it for myself like my own little ministry of sorts, because I see the good that it's doing. I think there's more to it than that. I think it can be revolutionary in how we approach everything from, approaching war to how we interact with animals and other people. And, when you have, for example, in mind that there's a good chance that you're going to see this from the other person's perspective, suddenly we're going to start seeing the world completely differently. If everybody just knew that it's possible that one day we're going to see our lives again from the perspective of everyone we ever met. Just that recognition of that possibility, of that happening, I think would do so much to increase compassion, to lessen abuse, to increase our ability to empathize with each other. Anyway, my point is, thank you for being here. Thank you for helping get the word out about these things. And thank you so much again for listening.